Hi, I'm Justin Mormon.
And I'm Katie Thornton, and this is the Reeducation of Schools podcast,
where we have open, honest conversations about how to better understand social-emotional learning, trauma-informed care, the whys behind student behavior, and how to help kids navigate it all as they go through school and life. All right, welcome back to our next episode, Love the Way You Lie, Prevalence-Induced Concept Change, which just really rolls off the tongue, quite frankly.
You hear it all the time.
Everybody's always talking about prevalence-induced concept change. Before we start kind of our new kickoff, right? If you've been enjoying the podcast, man, we really appreciate it. If you like it, if you share it, if you leave a review, that actually is a big deal. Kind of tricks the algorithms. I don't know, tricks them. It's just how they work. They know how they work that way. But it kicks them to where it's easier to find our podcast. It'd be great. We'd love it. Appreciate when you guys do that. So if you'd be so willing, we would love just for you to review it. Preferably in a good way. And that would really help us out. So Love the Way You Lie, Prevalence-Induced Concept Change. This was something I stumbled across a little bit ago. I'm not 100% sure even, I don't quite remember how I came across it. But as I started reading about it, because it immediately was interesting to me. And as I started reading about it, I started thinking, oh my gosh, like this is, I bet we do this in education all the time, you know, without really realizing it. We end up in this trap, I guess, that all humans, it seems like, fall into when it comes to solving problems.
Yeah. Just kind of
carried away, Katie. You were saying that you're pretty much going to run this one. So
I did look at Justin this. I said, so you've got this one, right? No, I did read and research about it. I do think it's fascinating. Kind of ties a lot into the unconscious bias, right?
Sure.
Yeah. It's basically the science behind the unconscious bias, right? Like, why do you perceive those things the way you do? And so we're going to talk a little bit how it's going to impact behavior and decisions in your classroom. But should probably start by, what is it? Because it was a new vocabulary for me, and I feel like...
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, so hopefully we're vocabulary expanding today for everybody. It's going to be the new buzzword in education.
Should that be like, because Josh has nothing but time on his hands, I know, but like he'll start putting vocabulary on the screen.
Yeah.
Like that's what you'll start doing.
We'll start a new hashtag, prevalence-induced concept change.
It's going to blow up.
It's going to blow up. Yeah. That's it.
All right. So what is it? What is prevalence-induced concept change? You want to answer this?
I'll answer it and then you kind of tie it up nice. Okay. All right. So it's from the co-author Daniel Gilbert explains that as we reduce the prevalence of a problem, such as discrimination, for example, we judge each new behavior to an improved context that we have created. We actually expand our definition of the problem to encompass more subtle variants. So essentially, it's your unconscious bias, and you're looking and perceiving the problem, and then you put more things in that category as being the problem because to kind of fulfill the perception that you have.
Yeah, and actually specifically as you reduce the initial problem.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's basically that idea, right? That as a problem is reduced, we naturally expand what we identify as being part of that problem. So one of the quotes that I thought was helpful was also by Daniel Gilbert. And he said, because there were like two kind of main articles we looked at, I think. Maybe you just looked at one.
Yeah, you only sent me one. You wanted to be the expert on this.
I went with the one that sounded less sciencey because I was getting lost in the more sciencey one. but the one that was a little less sciencey said, like, another way to say this is that solving problems causes us to expand our definitions of them. So when problems become rare, we count more things as problems. So our studies suggest, this is all Daniel Gilbert, our studies suggest that when the world gets better, we become harsher critics of it. And this can actually cause us to mistakenly conclude that it hasn't actually gotten better at all. Progress, it seems, tends to mask itself. So what they basically did is they did these tests. This isn't just like somebody's idea, right? They did a bunch of tests. I want to say the tests were early. I think the articles we were reading were more from like 2018-ish. But I think the initial trials, I don't know what else they call them, were around 2013 is when they started looking at all this stuff. And basically what they were doing from Harvard, I believe. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying a lot of facts that I don't know if they're true or not. This is why it's important to do your own research, people. Like, go out and do your own research. Don't
You're
just
correct.
Take what I say
You're
as
correct.
Yeah, I'll as back truth. You. Do you know that it's Harvard?
Yeah.
Okay. So we are confident now that it was Harvard. Anyway, what they were doing is taking like 1,000, taking these people that were in this test. They were showing them 1,000 dots. and to start out. And the dots varied anywhere from like being very purple to being very blue. And they were asked the simple question, is this dot blue? And they had to say, yes, it's blue. No, it's not blue. Okay. About 200 trials in, like about 200 of the pictures in of dots, they started to decrease the number of blue dots. So there's fewer and fewer blue dots being shown. What happened was that people started identifying purple dots as blue dots. So we're seeing fewer blue dots. So now I'm going to start calling purple dots blue. Even in the trials where the researchers told the people what was going to happen, this is what I thought was super interesting. So they even started, so they did the trials first time around, and what they realized, you know, hey, people definitely start saying purple dots are blue because they're looking for the blue dots, the problem.
They feel like they're failing if they don't identify.
I have to keep identifying that there's blue dots. I know that's my job is to find blue dots. So I'm seeing less of them. So I'm going to say a purple dot's blue now without really thinking about it. What's crazy to me is what's like a wild thought to me is that they started telling people, hey, about 200 trials in, we're going to start showing you fewer blue dots. Then they started saying like, hey, really, really focus in, really don't change your definition of a blue dot. Okay. Like really keep it as the same. We don't want it to change what your definition is. And they same results, still started calling purple dots blue. They started offering people money to not change their definition of what a blue dot was. Hey, you do this well. You don't expand your definition of a blue dot. You stick with it. There's a monetary incentive. Still couldn't do it. They still continued to over-identify blue dots where there weren't any. In the purple dots. I thought that was pretty crazy. So, they didn't just do this with dots, right? They did it with computer generated faces, and they were trying to decide if the faces looked agitated or not.
Yeah. I thought that was probably the most interesting study, because I think we hear that a lot in terms of DEI work about unconscious bias in terms of looking at people and whether they look threatening or not. Right.
Yeah.
And
that's basically what it was. Does this person look agitated? Do they look like they're mad? And as they started showing them about 200 trials in, right? As soon as they started trying to show them fewer agitated faces, people started looking at either neutral faces or even whatever the opposite of agitated is. Happy faces.
Joyful, calm, relaxed. Yeah.
They started identifying some of those faces as being agitated as well because they're looking for it. Right. If you're looking for agitated faces, you're going to see them. And I thought that was interesting. They also did it with things like, cause they did seven different types of trials and all of this. And they even did it with, is something like a moral study to do or thesis to have kind of thing. And, people started expanding what they thought was immoral. They started saying like, oh, this isn't moral, even though
the studies were shown to be unethical or unethical.
Yeah, thank you. Unethical.
Yeah, they were, even though the people participating knew that the studies were what ethical meant, they were wavering on some of the studies that they knew should be thrown out.
Yeah. So when the prevalence of blue dots, whatever that happens to be, decreases, if we're looking for blue dots, our concept of blue dots is going to expand. Melissa, my wife, she asked for what's like a real life example? Cause she has to hear about anything I'm thinking about all the time. Right. So, and she's very gracious and listening all the time, but she was like, what's a real life example? So I was looking that up. Somebody referenced cause it's not always bad. Like this doesn't always have to be bad, right? Somebody referenced an emergency room doctor. Yeah. And so if you're an emergency room doctor and there's some tragedy and there's 30 people come in with gunshot wounds, right? And then there's also a person there with a broken arm. Well, they're going to look around and be like, okay, what registers as an emergency to me is a gunshot wound. That person with a broken arm is not an emergency right now, right? But you take it a day later. And now all of a sudden the emergency room's basically empty. You got a broken arm, a person with a couple, you know, broken nose, and somebody that drank something they shouldn't have drank. And now they're poisoned, you know, whatever. Yeah. They're going to change what their perception of emergency is. Like they're going to expand it Because they're like, oh, I'm not seeing like the most intense thing anymore. So now I'm going to expand it to lesser things. Which apparently in my world is poisoned. If you're poisoned, that's apparently but you get the picture. Like, so there's good ways that we do it too. Our brains do this on purpose, not just because, not because we're awful people, just because we have to sometimes expand what our thoughts are on things to adjust for the situation. Right.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, if our whole world is looking for a problem, if we get too stuck looking for a problem, then we're going to start seeing that problem in places, even as that problem decreases.
Yeah. Isn't that true with the news cycle? We only report typically bad news.
Yeah.
And if you think about the structures of a lot of school team-based meetings, we're looking at the kids who are not doing well.
Yeah.
Kids that need intervention.
Yeah, we've talked about this at school before, yeah.
Yeah, this has been, there's been a good conversation that unfortunately we all came around the table and we talked for an hour and a half about all the things that the kids can't do. So that's been the
to try to solve problems.
To try to solve problems and put interventions in place, right? That's what we have to do. We need to do that. But unfortunately, we just aren't able to spend, because of time, the same equitable amount of time saying, let's sit around and talk about all the progress and how well kids are doing.
Yeah. In class of 20, we're talking about maybe 3 or 4 kids.
Yeah.
And we are much less likely to sit around and talk about the 15
kids that just aced that assignment. Yeah. The lesson went really well. We are set up just structurally in education to talk about the needs for interventions and not always the needs or the accomplishments or success or things that went really well a lot of times. So, yeah.
Okay. So like that's really starting the segue into like, what is this, how does this impact our view on behavior in schools?
Yeah. I think this really made a lot of sense to me. So we have a kid that has behavioral issues. We're always assuming the child's we're waiting for the child to mess up or seem to presume that it's always going to be the worst, right? When we believe the child is quote unquote bad, we're writing the narrative to exist that for our own sanity, right? That, well, everything that the child does is perceived as wrong, even though a same age peer, typical, maybe doing the exact same thing, that child does it. We're looking for the thing that they're going to do to mess up or they're going to need intervention or support on. So we're kind of set up. That's ultimately how the unconscious bias works with kids. So a lot of, I think, with perception of kids with behavior, we're looking at them in the classroom setting and we're seeing maybe things that were just we're micro-focusing on those things for kids, even though if we look at sampling of the rest of the class, I don't know if that kid's really doing anything different than some of the other kids. It's that lens shift that we talk about a lot.
Yeah. So in like my world, special education world, right? One of the things like I've noticed over years, and don't hear this as like necessarily like you're wrong if you're doing these things, but one of the things that is quick for us to do throughout my career has been, and where I was at before, everyone did this, just in our separate facility. But you had point sheets, right? This student's having really tough behavior. So we're going to identify what those behaviors are and we're going to track them on a point sheet so that we can have good data or data, depending on which makes you sound smarter. And we're gonna track what this behavior is in that way. And what I started noticing pretty early on was students that were doing by and large really well and were not having many issues, the people that were tracking points would get to the end of the time frame, you know, the end of that hour or whatever, the end of that class period, whatever it might be. They'd take a look at what the categories were and they'd be like, maybe they weren't yelling out and being super disruptive, but they did talk out that one time without raising their hand. Even if, to your point, everyone else in the class also was talking out without raising their hands and it was almost even maybe accepted, but they're like, well, I'm going to, yeah, that kind of was that. And maybe I have like, real aggressive, like threat, no threats. You know, your kid can't make a threat. That's one of the things I'm tracking. Like, are they threatening people or not? And they're like, well, they didn't necessarily make a direct threat, but they did talk in like a really mean way. And that kind of could be a threat. And so I'm going to mark that, you know, when in reality, if you were just sitting there, you didn't have something that you were looking at to track, you probably would have been like, oh, this kid had a pretty good class. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think to me, I'm like, I think I accidentally probably swung the other direction then when I realized that this was what was happening. And then I was almost letting too much go. It's really hard though. Mm-hmm. If you're like hyper focused on really looking at somebody. I always say all the time, if somebody walked around, followed me around all day and tracked what I was doing every hour and marked it down, I'd probably look like a way worse person than what I do. Just if you took the body of what I do on a daily basis as a whole. Right. So that's like one of the things that I notice that we do. I'm not saying you don't track behavior or you don't track things. I just think it's one of the ways that this impacts what we do on a daily basis. So in any classroom, doesn't have to be special education, right? But any classroom, like you're saying, you have a student who has tough behavior. It's, you know, August, September, you identify, this kid's doing this a lot in this first 3 weeks. Then by, you know, the end of September, you're looking for like, oh, I noticed that kid was doing it. I got used to looking for that kid doing that thing. Even if by mid-October, the kid's doing it way less, I'm looking for it now. Mm. I'm looking for the blue dot because I've gotten used to looking for that problem. So now I'm identifying it, even though maybe it's gotten better. Maybe we're not having that behavior, that action anymore. It doesn't exist, but I continue to look for it. And then I erroneously, potentially, am saying that a kid is doing worse than what they are. Because of that.
Yeah. That's why, you know, I think our next point is that knowing this can impact behavior, like just looking at intentional steps.
Yeah.
That we've got to start leaning on data, to your point. But the data, we need to use the same age peer comparisons when we look at data. So I think it's how we collect data. That's what you have to lean on to having a really good school psych. We've got to look at, that's why the trauma-informed FBAs are important, so that we're looking at holistic needs of kids. To Dr. Ross Green's point a lot, it's okay, the behavior happens, but it's the now what? Trying to kind of get up through the collaborative problem solving and really leaning into making those data, instead of I feel like this is happening a lot or I'm looking and my perception is, really, is it a measurable outcome so that we're not doing subjective data? To your point, like, yeah, like how are we defining yelling out? How are we like, let's get some clinical backing on what we're actually tracking so that it's not, we can get rid of the subjective part.
Yeah.
So when you can start really defining, Dr. Ross Green calls it clumped and unclumped behavior. So a lot of times we clump, like they can't walk in the hall. Okay, when are they walking in the hall? What does walking in the hall look like? It's really, a lot of his work is really getting through and like defining down to the T the exact problem. And so when we get more specific about behavior, then we can start keeping track of better data to help support, not always looking for a blue dot.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think very much to that point, right? Like I think part of that comes down to not waiting super long either, not training ourselves to look for that, not letting ourselves go so long that we're trained to look for that problem without having tried to solve the problem with the student, right? If we identify it's a problem in early August, early September, whatever it is, and then we wait and we're just annoyed by it for the next 5 weeks and we keep looking for it, but we don't do anything about it with the student to try to figure out why it's happening and then to come up with a plan to solve it. The earlier we do those things, the earlier we have those conversations or work on solving the problem with the student, the less likely we are going to be to just constantly be looking for that behavior, I think. Right. So I think like actually trying to solve the problem with the student early is going to be a key instead of letting ourselves become trained to look for the blue dot that the student has. Right.
Yeah. We talk about this a lot on the podcast, but I think for staff, intentional step would be for staff to be aware of their own regulation state. When you are dysregulated in any relationship, you are not looking for someone's best.
Sure.
You are looking your patience level. Essentially, this is what we talk about with the window of tolerance. You are looking at everyone's misstep and microanalyzing it because you're not regulated to really analyze a situation, whether it's with a kid, with an adult, with your spouse, with a friend, right? You're more hypercritical when you're not regulated yourself. So be mindful of where you're at with the state of mind. So when you are collecting data and think about how that possibly could be influencing the potential outcome. I have noticed this. I remember when I was pregnant with my first daughter in my first grade gen ed class, my window of tolerance was, I was not in that green, ready to go, right? So I probably was more hypercritical on some students that I shouldn't have been. I think I've talked about this before. And I felt really bad, but I was looking for the blue dot all the time. And so I think be mindful about where you're at and then have a team around you to kind of, so it's not just your decision-making influencing. This is why we have lots of team members come in and analyze to kind of keep that unconscious bias variance out of the mix when we're making behavioral decisions.
Yeah. I like that point for sure about the team, because what the study ultimately tells us is, and what, Daniel, whatever, I forget his name already,
but Gilbert, Gilbert.
If you want to come be on the podcast, let us know. But what ultimately they say is, like, they don't know. They don't have a solution for how to make us not, right? Even in the studies, they were trying to monetarily incentivize, like, people to not do this, and people couldn't. And people weren't that emotionally invested as what we are in our classrooms. You know, I mean, I don't think they were as emotionally invested in identifying
whether the dot was,
whether the dot was blue or purple, right? But, and they still couldn't do it. And that, to his point, at the end of one of the articles when he was being interviewed, he said, you know, that's why we call it continued research, or the phrase, you know, continued research is needed, exists, is because we need to continue to research to figure out what is it that we can do. Because based on their research, there's nothing we can do about it. Which isn't super encouraging. Now, I think to your point, there is stuff in education we can do to set ourselves up. And I think one of the big things is having a team, right? And not just going about it solo. It would be interesting to have the same study going where 500 dots in. Now, all of a sudden, you bring in an outside perspective of two other friends of yours, and they just now are starting. And they're like, what are you, crazy? That's definitely a purple dot. Mm-hmm. Like, don't call that one blue. That's definitely purple. Like, you know, like, what would happen then if you brought in more than one person at once? So, Daniel, if you're out there, maybe that's your next study. What happens if you bring people in? But I think then all of a sudden you have a fresh perspective, right? It's also why, and we talk about this frequently, like, teachers, gen ed teachers for sure, you can feel like you're on an island, like a deserted island on your own in your classroom. Like, this is just, it's your place. You can feel like everything, you know, that's happening inside those four walls is everything that's happening in the world is inside your classroom. It can be easy for it to feel that way. And so if it's just you and you're just trying to make the decisions and you're just trying to identify the things, that's incredibly difficult. And that's why we also talk about, like, real time, assistance for people that are working with students with tough behavior, is not just always talking about it afterwards. I mean, there's obvious value in that, and not just hearing about it written on a report or written down as a note or having a kid sent to the office. And but it's actually having somebody in there with a teacher in real time, working with them on how to identify stuff or helping them identify from a fresh perspective what's going on.
Modeling, coaching. How powerful is modeling, coaching?
Yeah. All those things, right? So if we're on our own, what this study to me says, if we're on our own, we are going to fail at this. Like, we can't, we cannot, we don't know how to make our brains not do this. No matter what we do. And so we can't do it on our own. It's a good point to me as to why we're not supposed to be isolated, you know, individuals, but, like, we're supposed to be in relationship with people, and we're supposed to do things in relationship with people. And I think kids benefit from that in any number of ways that have nothing to do with this. But I think this is another way that kids benefit from us as adults, as the staff working collaboratively and not just being on islands or secluded on our own in our own little rooms all the time.
Yeah, that collective care, we know there's power in terms of regulation, reasoning, all of that helps when you have others with you.
Okay, so let's say you have a colleague that's kind of stuck in this loop, or if you're listening to this right now and you're like, ah, crap, like, I'm stuck in this loop, like, I think I'm probably doing this.
Yeah, and if you're a teacher right now in America, I would think put myself back in the classroom for all the years I've done it. I did this every year. There was always one kid was a blue dot in my class, and you've got to overcome it. So yes, if you're stuck.
Yeah. So what do we do?
I was thinking really through kind of like just about what we were just talking about. So I'm a big fan of the book, The Rabbit Listen. We use this a lot in training. I think it's a beautiful model of co-regulation, or how interactions happen in terms of trying to solve problems for somebody, and then ultimately the rabbit solves it with somebody just by being the regulator, right? So think about if you have a colleague that's stuck. I think you do this better than I do. I'm working on it, but to really listen to somebody and not try to fix it, because my ultimate go-to is always like, okay, you have a problem. Great. Here's what we're going to do. X, Y, and Z. Sometimes we need to get there at that point, but I often try to fix it for somebody right in the moment. So be the rabbit, be there to talk and listen, because somebody is frustrated. They are frustrated. They need to have somebody to listen and validate that they're not crazy, that they're the blue dot if for them exists in that scenario, right? Lean on the data. Think about non-biased support systems that can come in and support, like your special education coordinator. Woo woo too. So ours is amazing. your school psych, your principal, maybe an intervention specialist is not working in your classroom. Maybe it's another IS, right? Or a para. Think about unconscious people that can come in and kind of give you objective, your school counselor. Be open to feedback. Be open to being reflective and responsive to the possibility that maybe you're looking for the blue dot.
Yeah, because for sure what would happen is at some point we're going to do this to each other, right? I can only imagine is we're going to be fired up about something. We're going to be seeing something that's more prevalent. And one of us just saying blue dot, your blue dot. Nobody's going to probably
receive in that
moment be like, you know what? You're right. Let's have a rational conversation. It's going to fire me up. Like if you said it to me, but that doesn't mean, I think that goes back to relationship, right? Like what kind of relationships do you have with those colleagues that you trust, who you hopefully can have that they're like, you know, in a nice way, like, hey, I think let's step back. Like, what if we considered the idea that this is one of those situations where we're maybe over identifying it or maybe it's not, maybe the thing is actually getting worse and we need to do something different about it. But let's try to identify which of those two things it is. Like, are we over identifying something now? Are we seeing blue dots where they're purple or are there actually just more blue dots right now? And we actually need to make an adjustment that direction because it could be both. I mean, that's the problem. It's not always just going to decrease in real life. In real life, there actually may be more blue dots coming. Like, and we need to be able to know how to tell the difference between the two situations. I don't know how you do that individually. I think you have to have.
It can be without a team. I think we often talk a lot about kids lacking skills to identify them. I've noticed a shift when we start asking, hey, tell me something good that happened today. I think when we start asking and looking for positive things and start looking at positive data trends and start trying to have part of our conversation to be, tell me what's going really well. And celebrating the success for the kids and the teachers, that starts helping making that lens shift that we're starting to look for. Oh my gosh, they did do that today.
Sure.
That did go really well. I'm so excited. And be willing to listen as much as you are willing to listen for when they're not doing well. Listen to your colleague when it does go really well and make a big deal about it.
Yeah.
You know?
I think one thing is awareness too, right? Like we both said, like we had no idea, that prevalence induced concept change. Even I had to look to even read it. Right. It's so much like I didn't realize it was a thing. I certainly didn't realize that the studies showed what they showed about it. And that it's almost impossible to just make yourself. I'm a pretty big, like I can will myself to do a lot of things kind of person, probably to a fault. It's one of my faults for sure. And I, to be able to hear a study that says like, you can't, I would have told, if you would have told me about this before, I probably would have been like, no, I'm sure I can like step back enough and be impartial enough. And even if you're better at it than most people, you still can't completely do it. Like you just can't. And so I think awareness, like helping people know that this is a thing that exists. This is part of how our brains work, as a whole. And, that it definitely can impact us in our classroom is a big one. So, hey, maybe have people listen to this podcast. Maybe give them the vocabulary, maybe,
talk about the study with your, colleagues,
staff meeting, right?
Just
throw it out. It doesn't have to be a whole staff meeting, but maybe it's part of a quick, like, hey, this is something that we know about.
Yeah.
And food for thought, take it and think about it and move on with the rest of the staff meeting.
I'm even thinking about this now as we're talking, even about, adult perception, maybe of other adults. That we're looking for, especially when you're in administration, that's a hard job. or a leader of a team of some sort, right? We're always looking for them to mess up, right?
Yes.
That's the hard part about being a leader in any capacity, no matter what you're doing, or a coach or whatever role you're in. When you no longer become the equal peer and the quote unquote expert on something, we're looking for the blue dot. We're waiting for somebody to disagree with their decision-making, their change. So I would say, as much as we talk about kids, think about maybe staff dynamics in terms of, are you waiting for someone to mess up?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think relationships, again, is always kind of the key, whether it's with the students in your room or with colleagues, right? Is put the work in on the front end to have good relationships. Don't wait till you need to like leverage a relationship to get something that you need. Like actually build good relationships with people in the front end so that when something does arise like this, you're open to hearing from colleagues. They're open to hearing from you. Students are open to having a conversation with you. It doesn't feel like it's awkward or they're in trouble or whatever else. Like, but there's actually just dialogue. There's actually a relationship there. So work on that on the front end, I think, is always, that never hurts us. That never is.
Builds your relational currency, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So you can cash in.
All right. So what would you want people to walk away from this episode knowing? It's kind of an interesting one.
Yeah. I think I learned a lot just from reading. It makes a lot of sense. I think it ties into a lot to the DEI work that we've researched and studied about unconscious bias and microaggressions and those kind of things and why this actually happens. So it kind of is like more the data and research behind all that. I think just be aware, make sure you're leaning on data and like the right type of data to make sure you're making informed decisions. Think about your own state of mind and think about how you can put plans in place that can support everyone with this in terms of kids, families, and your fellow educators.
Families is another good one. Yeah.
Where I mean, we have so many families that come through and they're the Blue Dot family.
Sure.
That we've already made our decision, have preconceived notions, already a prop right. And so then we're just looking for the blue dots all the time.
Yeah, we're expecting if we have to make a phone call home about something, we're expecting it's going to go poorly.
This is how it's going to go, and we've got to start.
And even if it doesn't go that poorly, we identify those poor parts of the
tone. It was the tone or the vocabulary they used.
We're looking for it. Yeah, we expand it. Yeah.
Yep.
I think that's interesting. I think I was just thinking about this as you were talking. I think, people can get people can have a lot of feelings that come along with like when you start talking about like DEI or like unconscious bias, like all those things can like evoke a lot of feelings in people for good or for bad. I mean, they can make people immediately get defensive and things like that. And I think this is like, again, a little bit more of like a benign kind of study to look at to show the same kind of thing, right? Without having to make people feel maybe as uncomfortable. And I'm not saying people shouldn't feel uncomfortable. Don't hear that. But with being able to maybe help people feel a little bit more comfortable understanding the concept. Again, I think there's just a lot of value in looking at something that's like the scientific study that has to just do with like how our brains work. So that was kind of my off the cuff response to what you were saying. I do think talking about stuff like this can be super, super helpful. Again, obviously pushing our podcast, right? You're listening to it, but I'm going to keep pushing it. So I think a great episode to listen to for people. If you're going to have conversations about stuff like that, this would be a great one. And certainly the articles and things like that. I think that awareness, really, that's really what it comes down to me for me is like awareness is key. Like, hopefully be aware that this is a thing and start looking for it in your own life some. Not just in your classroom of behavior, but in all aspects of your life. Where are you doing this? And try to be aware and try to start thinking that through and have conversations about it with people so that it's something that is in your mind, that it's not something that you just forget about and still fall into the same traps. Second, has nothing to do specifically with this, but I think it's just important, and I kind of harp on this a lot too, I think, but for good reason, I like to believe. I think it's super important that in education, keep educating yourself and keep learning about things that aren't just about education, right? This study wasn't an education study. It wasn't a study about schools. It wasn't marketed towards, hey, in schools, you should think about this and do this. But I think as we read about it, we're like, holy cow, like this definitely applies to a bunch of stuff. let yourself not get so stuck inside just the world of education that all you ever look at is things in education or that are put out specifically for people in education. I say that as somebody that's putting out content right now for people in education, yeah. but understand, like, there is so much value in looking at all kinds of things, learning in all kinds of ways. And then just recently we were in a place, somebody was talking about beekeeping, right? And yeah. then they applied it to the situation. Like, take the things that you learn and that you enjoy and that you learn about in your own personal life that are your hobbies and that are your joys, and then find ways to apply that to how you work every day. I think there's a lot of value in that. And I think it keeps you from getting too bogged down just in education world.
Yeah. Because ultimately we're a human science business.
Yeah, sure.
It's a human experience that it's not so much, it's the art of teaching, right?
Yeah.
It's the people part.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Well, thank you guys for joining us. Hopefully you learned something today. I think we were,
I did.
I mean, we're even real time. Look at that. You're real time. You're hearing like us kind of think more deeply about this and be like, oh, you know, it could actually apply in this way, or it could mm-hmm. mean this too. We always love that you guys join in the conversation. We are increasingly getting questions. Continue to be patient with us. Remember, we're also currently at the time this is recording, we're at the end of our school year, right?
Yeah.
Just testing. We're trying to get everything done.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're a little bit slower than what we would like to be on response to you. Don't take offense to that. Hopefully, like, give us a little bit of grace in that. But keep sending us questions, keep sending us comments. We love hearing those things. Share this again. If you've found value in this podcast at all, whether it's this episode or others, leave a review. We'd love that. And, let's just go out there and do the work.
Yeah. Let's go do it.
Hey, everybody, let's keep the conversation going.
Like and subscribe below and keep the comments rolling.